Well, here we go. I'll just say it because y'all know what I'm going to say. It goes like this. Turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins. We are starting a brand new, well, it's an old book, but it's a new book, at least this Torah cycle. And that would be in English, Leviticus. In Hebrew, it's the first word in the book. And it says, Vayikra, and called Yahuwah, al Moshe. And he spoke to him out of the tent of meeting, the Mikdash, the Ohel of meeting. And what's interesting about this first verse is a couple things. One, it's got one of the many jots and tittles is the English phrase for it. The Aleph at the end of Vayikra is small, smaller than a normal Aleph. And so people always ask why. Well, and the answer is we're not 100% sure, but one of the things that is claimed is that the scribal notation indicates that this is the opposite of Adam, that Moshe is a meek individual. He is not trying to accelerate or accentuate his stature. So, and there's one other element in this, and that is that Rashi points out that there are a couple of ways of saying that the Hebrew verb here. And essentially the two have to do with whether or not this is something that is just happens, you know, like a chance meeting. Hey, over there, how you doing? Okay, or something that is done in love. And the indication from the verb, according to the Hebrew expert Rashi, is that it's a calling in love to Moshe. And that might help to explain the small Aleph as well. Well, okay, what does he say? He says, speak unto the B'nai Israel, tell them the following. When any man of you brings an offering, and that word here is korban in this case, an offering unto Yahuwah, you will bring your offering of the cattle, even of the herd of the flock. And the root word for korban evidently means it is of us, something that is offered of us. And then we're going to get some specifications, and this is where people say, oh, this is the boring stuff in Vayikra and Leviticus. And I will contend that there is a lot in here, and it's kind of interesting. And, of course, one of the things that the whore church misses by ignoring the things that they say are done away with. Now, they're not necessarily done away with because they are. You know, Yahushua said that not one yod or tittle would be done away with as long as heaven and earth still exist. Well, they do. So, obviously, that's not the case. But on the other hand, the place where he put his name does not exist. We cannot physically do this. We can still make different kinds of offerings. But, yeah, to the extent that this is not physically possible anymore in most cases, fine, but there's a lot of value in understanding it. So let's go through it and see what it says. So when a man brings an offering, it's going to be out of the cattle or the herd of the flock. And if it's a burnt offering, now the word there in Hebrew is olah, from the herd. It is to be the following, a male without blemish. He brings it to the door of the tent of meeting, and that he may be accepted before Yahuwah. Now, what I've always thought was kind of interesting about this, and this is one of those places where I'll add just a little bit, hopefully, of my own understanding from having raised animals. Now, I hadn't done that before when I first started studying Torah, but I do think there's some value in it and some things that we begin to appreciate that maybe I didn't, and a lot of folks don't. If they've never dealt with animals, especially things like goats or cattle, it says this, man who brings this offering is to lay his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. So this whole idea of lay his hand is kind of interesting. Why? And I can't tell you that we know the reason for it, but having gone through it and having raised animals, I can kind of suggest that, at least to me, this is an emotional issue. There's an attachment. Now, maybe if the man just buys the animal, he doesn't have the attachment. But if he's raised it, I guarantee you, there's bound to be some attachment to put your hand upon the head of this animal that is shortly going to give up its life as an offering is got to be moving. I can't believe for a second. And you know, having raised animals, I know that that's the case. He shall kill the bullock before Yahuwah, Aaron's sons, the Kohanim, shall present the blood, dash the blood round about the altar at the door of the tent of meeting, and then he shall flay the burnt offering, cut it into its pieces, and the sons of Aaron the Kohen shall put fire on the altar and lay the wood in order upon the fire. And Aaron's sons, the Kohanim, the priests, they'll lay those pieces, the head, the suet, in order upon the wood that's on the fire upon the altar. A lot of specifications here for how it's going to be done. Some of this is going to be repetitious. Its innards and its legs he washes with water. The Kohen then makes the whole thing smoke on the altar for an olah, a burnt offering. Now, olah actually means lifted up. So that's what happens. The fire goes up. It's an offering made by fire, a sweet savor unto Yahuwah. And if his offering is one of the flock, whether it's of the sheep or of the goats, both of them, of course, clean animals, for a burnt offering, he shall offer, again, a male without blemish. And he shall kill it on the side of the altar north before Yahuwah. Aaron's sons, the Kohanim, shall dash its blood around the altar all about, cut it into pieces. Priest lays it on them with its head and its suet in order on the wood on the fire upon the altar. Notice the same verbiage. The innards and the legs he washes with water. Priest shall offer the whole, make it smoke upon the altar. It is a burnt offering, an offering made by fire, of a sweet savor unto Yahuwah. Now, if his offering to Yahuwah shall be a burnt offering of fowls or birds, then he brings his offering of turtle doves or young pigeons. This time the Kohen brings it under the altar, pinches off its head, makes its smoke on the altar. The blood thereof shall be drained out on the side of the altar. He takes away its crop, which is the little place in the front where it digests and holds food. The feathers, cast it beside the altar on the east part, in place where the ashes are. Then he rends it by the wings thereof, but does not divide it asunder. The priest shall make it smoke upon the altar, on the wood that's on the fire. It is a burnt offering, an olah, an offering made by fire, a sweet savor unto Yahuwah. Now, the second chapter says that when there is a nefesh. Now, the rendering in my English rendering here says, when any one. But I think it's interesting. The word in Hebrew is when any soul brings a meal offering unto Yahuwah. So meal offering is going to be grain of some kind. It is to be a fine flour. He pours oil upon it. He puts frankincense on it. He brings it to Aaron's sons, the Kohanim. He takes from this thing a handful of the fine flour and of the oil together with the frankincense. And the priest shall make the memorial part. In other words, what's the word that we use for the bread? The part that's taken out. Anyway, he makes a memorial part smoke upon the altar, and it's an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto Yahuwah. Okay, so challah was the word I was looking for there. That which is left of the meal offering is for Aaron. It's his and his sons. It is a thing most kadosh, set apart, of the offerings of Yahuwah made by fire. So it belongs to Aaron to eat. When you bring a meal offering baked in the oven, it's to be unleavened cakes, fine flour mingled with oil, or unleavened wafers spread with oil. If your offering is a meal offering baked on a griddle, it's to be fine flour, again unleavened, mixed or mingled with oil. The priest, you shall break it in pieces, pour oil on it. It is a meal offering. And that word, of course, is mincha, a meal offering. Now, if this offering, this korban, is a mincha from the stewing pan, it's to be made with fine flour, with oil. You bring the meal offering that is made of these things unto Yahuwah, and it will be presented unto the Kohen, and he brings it unto the altar. The priest takes off from it a memorial part thereof, and makes that smoke upon the altar. It is, right, an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto Yahuwah, but that which is left of the meal offering belongs to Aaron. It shall be Aaron's and his sons. It is a thing most kadosh, set apart, of the offerings of Yahuwah made by fire. So again, understand that one of the things, one of the primary purposes of the offering, of course, this is how Aaron and his sons, the Kohanim, this is how they eat. It is for their sustenance. No meal offering which you shall bring unto Yahuwah shall be made with leaven. So it's not got any leavening or yeast in it. You shall make no leaven nor any honey smoke as an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. As an offering of first fruits, you can bring them unto Yahuwah. But they are not to come up as a sweet savor on the altar. Every meal offering of mine you shall season with salt, nor shall you suffer the salt of the covenant of your El to be lacking from any meal offering. In other words, always have salt, and that's what it says. With all your offerings you shall offer salt. And when. Now, Rashi takes issue with the word, some English translations say, if you bring a meal offering. He says when, because this should happen. Of first fruits unto Yahuwah, bring for the meal offering of your first fruits corn in the ear, parched with fire, or groats of the fresh ear. You put oil on it, lay frankincense thereon. It is a mincha, an oil offering. And the priest again makes a memorial part of that smoke, even of the groats thereof, and the oil thereof, with all the frankincense thereof. It is an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. Now, if his offering is a shalamim, peace offering, it's a sacrifice or a zebak of shalamim, then if he offers of the herd, whether it's male or female, he shall offer it without blemish before Yahuwah. So a maimed or an animal that is crippled or whatever is not a suitable sacrifice. He lays his hand upon the head of his offering, kills it at the door of the tent of meeting, and Aaron's sons, the Kohanim, shall dash the blood against the altar round about. He shall present of the sacrifice of shalamim, of peace offerings, an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. The fat that covers the innards, all the fat that's upon the innards, the two kidneys and the fat that's on them, by the loins, the lobe above the liver, and which he shall take away hard by the kidneys. Aaron's sons shall make it smoke on the altar upon the wood the burnt offering, which is on the wood, on the fire. It's an offering, again, made by fire of a sweet savor unto Yahuwah. For his offering, if it is a zebak of shalamim unto Yahuwah, and it's of the flock, whether it's male or female, it is again to be without blemish. If he brings a lamb for his offering, then he shall present it before Yahuwah. And he lays his hand upon the head of his offering. Again, notice the hand upon the head. Kills it before the tent of meeting. Aaron's son shall dash the blood thereof against the altar round about. And he shall present of the zebach of peace offerings an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. The fat thereof, fat tail, the entire thing, he shall take it away hard by the rump bone, and the fat that covers the innards, all the fat that's on those, the two kidneys and the fat on them, which is by the loins, the lobe above the liver, take away all of it by the kidneys. The priest shall make it smoke upon the altar. It is the food of the offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. Now, if he offers a goat, then he shall present it before Yahuwah. He lays his hand again, same place, on the head, kills it before the tent of meeting, and the sons of Aaron shall dash the blood thereof against the altar round about. And he shall present thereof his offering, even an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. Same thing as before. The fat that covers the innards, all the fat that's on the innards, the two kidneys, and the fat that's on them, which is by the loins, the lobe above the liver, which he shall take away by the kidneys. And the priest shall make them smoke upon the altar. It is the food of the offering made by fire. For a sweet savor, all the fat is Yahuwah's. All the fat is to be is for Yod Heh Vav Heh. And this, here come these words again. It is a huchat olam, a perpetual statutes. You don't have to know why, just do it, and it's forever, throughout your generations and all your dwellings, that you shall eat neither fat nor blood. Now, this is important. A lot of the things, notice, that we've been talking about in this Torah portion, we can't offer. The Kohanim, as a group that we know of, there may be a gene that can be identified in the DNA, but other than that, we do not know or have an official set of Kohanim at this point, nor do we have a place for them to make these offerings. But on the other hand, you can eat or should eat neither fat nor blood. That, because it says it's a perpetual statute, that we can still do. So don't eat fat nor blood. Now, and I guess one of the things you'll note about both of these is, does that mean that if there's so much as a, you know, one little corpuscle of blood or a fat molecule in there that you've violated it? No. That's obviously not what you're talking about, because you can't physically, they wouldn't have had the technology, and even today it would be almost impossible to get rid of every, tiny, tiny bit of blood or fat. But what we can do is cut the fat off and drain the blood. So that's essentially what it's talking about. We don't eat them especially. Next chapter says, Yahuwah then spoke unto Moshe, and he said the following, speak unto the B'nai Israel, saying the following, if any one shall sin through error. Now let's pause. As we go through this, I'm going to note, this is key and it's very important. Is one of the things that the Sunday church just tends to completely ignore. because you'll hear it taught, oh, we don't have any more sacrifice. There's no sacrifice that remains. Well, Paul, of course, as you know, made offerings in the temple that would have been considered sacrifices because of a Nazirite vow after the time of Yeshua. So that's not a correct teaching. But notice one other thing. We're going to see this in this entire chapter 4 and into the next one, that it says if somebody sins through error, they make a mistake, they didn't know, then what? And you notice, we're not talking about deliberate rebellion. I knew it, I don't give a blankety blank. The heck with the God of the Bible. That is not at all what we're talking about. This is sinning through error. And of course, here's the key. As we go through this, you're going to see that there is I like to call it like a wood cutting, where the negative image tells the story. Because what is pointedly missing is a sacrifice, any sacrifice, for deliberate, intentional rebellion to Him. That is what we're not going to see. So, if anybody sins through error, though, in any of the things which Yahuwah has commanded not to be done, but he ends up doing one of them, then if it's going to be one of these following types. So if it is the anointed Cohen who does that, wow, see, you'd think he might know better. But he sins so as to bring guilt on the people, then let him offer for his sin. Now, the root word here is kata, which he has sinned, a young bull without blemish, unto Yahuwah for a sin offering. So the sin offering is a chatat. And he brings the young bull under the door of the tent of meeting before Yahuwah. He lays, again, his hand upon the head of the bull and kills the bullock before Yahuwah. So here we see it again. Lay your hand on the head of this animal. This animal is going to die. And it's sad. You didn't know any better. Poor animal suffers for your ignorance. And the anointed priest shall take the blood of the bullock and bring it to the tent of meeting. And the priest shall now, he does this triple dip. He dips his finger in the blood, and he sprinkles the blood 7 times before Yahuwah in front of the veil of the sanctuary. And then he puts the blood upon the horns of the altar of sweet incense before Yahuwah in the tent of meeting. And all the remaining blood of the bullock shall he pour out at the base of the altar burnt offering, which is at the door of the tent of meeting. And the fat of the bullock of the sin offering, the chatat, he shall take off from it. So he removes the fat that covers the innards, the fat that's on the innards, the 2 kidneys, the fat that's on them, by the loins, the lobe above the liver, he takes away by the kidneys. As it is taken from off the ox of the sacrifice of Shalamim. So it's a similar process. And the priest shall make them smoke upon the altar of burnt offering. But the skin of the bullock and its flesh with its head and its with its legs and all of its innards and its dung, even the whole bullock shall be carried forth outside of the camp into a clean place where the ashes are poured out and burn it on wood with fire. Where the ashes are poured out, that's the place where it shall be burnt. Now, that was part A, okay? If an anointed Cohen sins, how about this one? Verse 13 says, and if the whole congregation, Kol Edat Israel, all of them, they err, the thing being hid from the eyes of the assembly. See, nobody knows it. What happened? We don't know. They do any of the things which Yahuwah has commanded not to be done, and in fact, they're guilty. When the sin wherein they have sinned is known, comes out, uh-oh, then the assembly shall offer a young bull for a sin offering and bring it before the tent of meeting. Now this time it's the elders of the congregation that lay their hands as representatives, as leaders, upon the head of the bullock before Yahuwah, and the bullock shall be killed before Yahuwah. The anointed priest shall bring the blood of the bullock to the tent of meeting. The priest shall dip his finger in the blood, and again he sprinkles it 7 times before Yahuwah in front of the veil. He puts of the blood upon the horns of the altar before Yahuwah, which is in the tent of meeting. All the remaining blood he pours out at the base of the altar of burnt offering at the door of the tent of meeting. All the fat thereof shall be taken from off it. He makes it smoke on the altar. Then he does with the bullock as he did with the bullock of the sin offering, the chatat. So does he do this time with this one. And the Kohanim shall make atonement for them, and they shall be forgiven. And he shall carry forth the bullock outside the camp and burn it, just as he did the first bullock. It is a sin offering for the assembly, literally for the Ha'idah, or the Kahal in this case is the assembly. Now, Are we done yet? Well, no, there's going to be another one that sins unintentionally. How about a prince or a ruler, a nasi? When he sins, and he does through error, any one of the things which Yehoahazel has commanded not to be done, he is guilty. Shouldn't have done it, but he did. If his sin, wherein he sinned, is known to him, or when it becomes known to him, well, then he shall bring for his offering a goat, a male without blemish, and he lays his hand, again, same process, upon the head of the goat. The poor goat is going to die because he was ignorant. He kills it in the place where they killed the burnt offering before Yahuwah. It is a chatat, a sin offering. Priest shall take of the blood of the sin offering with his finger, right? We know what's going to happen. He puts it on the horns of the altar, the burnt offering. Notice, there's one thing missing. It's always kind of interesting. He takes the blood of the sin offering with his finger, puts it on the horns of the altar of the burnt offering, and the remaining blood he pours out at the base of the altar of burnt offering. But I don't see the part in there about where he sprinkles it seven times. Let's see. Yep, the other two, they get sprinkled seven times. It's interesting because sometimes we'll notice that the process is almost identical, but there is a difference. And I, you know, if people are going to ask why, and the answer is, I'm not sure. But I guarantee you, it's important if even by omission, the Torah leaves out something in this particular part. So, if it's all the congregation, or if it is an anointed priest, then we do this seven times sprinkle thing. But in the case of this time, where it is the Nasi, the ruler, the prince, that doesn't happen. He takes the blood, he puts it on the horns of the altar, and the remaining blood he pours out at the base of the altar burnt offering. The fat thereof shall be made to smoke upon the altar, as the fat of the sacrifice of Shalamim. Priest shall make atonement for him as concerning his sin, and he shall be forgiven. So the rest is similar. All right, well, we're not done yet. How about an individual? If any one of the common people, the people of the land, sin through error, and this is an interesting, be shagaga, in ignorance. They do one of the things which Yahuwah has commanded not to be done, and they're in fact guilty. Well, then this sin, which he has sinned, when it becomes known to him, then he shall bring for his offering a goat. Now this time, interestingly, it is a female without blemish for his sin which he has sinned. Now, I'll make one other observation at this point, because again, when it's something that is slightly different, it ought to kind of catch our interest, and we ought to say why. And I've always thought, well, what's the difference? Is there a sexual difference between the male and the female? Well, obviously there is. But has it got something to do with why one of them is for the prince and the other is for a person that's a common folk? Because what also interests me here is, if you have raised animals, you understand that in most places and in most cases, a female cow, unless there are some exceptions like, you know, a prize, a bull stud or something. But as a general rule, certainly this is true with goats, and that's what we're talking about here. The female goat is almost always worth more than the male goat. Why? Well, clearly, because female goats can have more kids. Male goats, they can impregnate kids, but one male will do a whole bunch of females. So we don't need as many males as we do females. That's why most of the time the sacrifices are of male goats. And females are more viable also because, of course, they can be milked. So he brings a female. This is a more expensive offering if you think about it in terms of what is being sacrificed here. Then he shall lay his hand upon the head of the sin offering, kill the sin offering in the place of the burnt offering. The priest shall take of the blood thereof with his finger and put it upon the horns of the altar of burnt offering. And all the remaining blood he shall pour out the base of the altar. Notice it again. This is the same thing as what we just saw. No sprinkle seven times. All the fat thereof he takes away. As the fat is taken away from the sacrifice of Shalamim, priest shall make a smoke on the altar for a sweet savor unto Yahuwah, and the priest shall make atonement for him, and he shall be forgiven. Now, if he brings a lamb as his offering for a katat, a sin offering, again, it is a female without blemish. And he shall lay his hand upon the head of the sin offering and kill it for a sin offering in the place where they killed the burnt offering. The priest shall take of the blood. Why are we seeing the same process repeated almost identically? And in one case, it's a sheep, and in the other case, it's a goat. Both cases, it's a female. Priest shall take of the blood of the sin offering with his finger, puts it on the horns of the altar, no sprinkling, and all the remaining blood shall be poured out at the base of the altar. All the fat thereof is taken away, as the fat of the lamb is taken away from the sacrifice of Shalamim. The priest shall make them smoke on the altar upon the offerings of Yahuwah made by fire. The priest shall make atonement for him as touching his sin that he has sinned, and he shall be forgiven. All right, chapter 5. Now it says, if anyone sins, in that he hears the voice of adjuration, he being a witness, whether he's seen or known, if he does not utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity. We see something? We're supposed to talk about it? Or if anyone touches any unclean thing, whether it's the carcass of an unclean beast, or the carcass of unclean cattle, or the carcass of unclean swarming things, and is guilty, and it's hidden from him that he is unclean, or if he touches the uncleanness of man, whatsoever his uncleanness be, wherewith he is unclean, and it's hidden from him, when he knows of it, now he's guilty. Or if anyone swears clearly with his lips to do evil, or to do good, whatsoever it be that a man shall clearly utter with an oath, and it's hidden from him, and when he knows of it, he's guilty in one of these things. So we got a list of things that people can be guilty of, and it might be hidden and they might not know it. Now, how can you make an uttering of your lips and not know it? I guess most of us can probably relate to that. We've said things, and what, did I really say that? I just was angry, I don't remember, right? Shall be that when he is found guilty in one of these things, that he shall confess that whereof he has sinned. Root word is interesting. It's yara there, which is an interesting word. Now, then he shall bring his forfeit, what he owes, unto Yahuwah for his sin which he sinned. Again, a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat, for a chatat, a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for him as concerning his sins. And suppose he's not got enough wealth. Remember, a female goat or kid of the lambs is a kind of an expensive sacrifice. So if he doesn't have enough money for that, then he brings his forfeit for that which he has sinned. In this case, two turtle doves or two young pigeons unto Yahuwah, one for a sin offering, the other for an olah, a burnt offering. And he shall bring them unto the priest, who shall offer that which is for the chatat, the sin offering, first. He pinches off its head by the neck, but does not divide it in parts. Then he shall sprinkle the blood of the sin offering upon the side of the altar, the rest of blood drained out at the base of the altar. It is chatat, a sin offering. And he shall prepare the second one for a burnt offering. According to the ordinance, the priest shall make atonement for him as concerning his sin which he sinned, and he shall be forgiven. Now, if his means don't suffice even for the two turtle doves or two young pigeons, then he shall bring his offering for that which he has sinned. This time it's going to be a minha, a tenth part of an ephah of fine flour for a chatat. He puts no oil on it, nor shall he put any frankincense thereon. Frankincense is expensive, folks. It is a chatat. He shall bring it to the priest. The priest, the Kohen, shall take the handful of it as a memorial part thereof, make it smoke on the altar upon the offerings of Yahuwah made by fire. It is a chatat. And the priest shall make atonement for him as touching his sin that he sinned in any of these things, and he shall be forgiven. Now, what about the rest? The remnant shall be the Kohen's as the meal offering. So he eats the rest too. Now, Yahuwah, it says, continued, he spoke to Moshe, and he said, if anyone commits a trespass, right? I didn't know I was trespassing on someplace. I committed something I didn't know it was wrong. A sin through error in the set-apart things of Yahuwah, okay, the holy things, then he shall bring his forfeit unto Yahuwah. A ram without blemish out of the flock, according to the valuation in silver by shekels, after the shovel of the sanctuary, for a guilt offering. And he shall make restitution for that which he's done amiss in the holy thing, and he shall add to it the fifth part. So he doesn't just make whatever it was that he messed up right. He adds 20%, a fifth part, to it. Gives it unto the Kohen. The priest shall make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering, and he shall be forgiven. And if anyone sins and does any of the things which Yahuwah has said should not be done, he's commanded they are not to be done, but he doesn't know it, yet he is guilty, then he shall bear his iniquity. And when he then does, he figures it out, he shall bring a ram without blemish out of the flock, according to your valuation, for a guilt offering unto the Kohen. and the priest shall make atonement concerning him for the error which he committed, though he knew it not, and he shall be forgiven. It is a guilt offering. He is certainly, it says, guilty before Yahuwah. He doesn't know it, but he's guilty. Then Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said the following. Now, this is kind of interesting, and it's, I've got this one highlighted, because it's not only a nice summary, but it's certainly something to pay attention to. If anyone sins, they commit a trespass against Yahuwah, and they deal falsely with their neighbor in a matter of deposit, or of a pledge, or of robbery, or they have oppressed their neighbor, or have found that which is lost. Oh, I didn't see it. Nope, don't know what happened to it. They lied. They dealt falsely therein, and they swear to a lie. In any or all of these cases, the things that a man does, sinning therein, well, it shall be, if he has sinned and is guilty, that he shall, restore that which he took, whether it was by robbery, or the thing that he'd gotten by oppression, or the deposit which was deposited with him, or the lost thing which he found. It was an ill-gotten gain. He restores it. Anything about which he's sworn falsely, he shall restore it in full, and add to it another fifth part, and give unto him to whom it appertains, shall he give in the day of his being guilty. So the person that he has wronged, he makes right, and he adds a fifth part to it. Then he shall bring his forfeit unto Yahuwah. This is a pricey reminder. He brings a ram without blemish out of the flock, according to your valuation, for a guilt offering unto the Kohen. And the Kohen shall make atonement for him before Yahuwah, and he shall be forgiven concerning whatsoever he does, so as to be guilty thereby. And that is where this particular Torah portion ends, folks. A rather lengthy portion, lots of stuff, and again, what's interesting to me, of course, even though we can say, oh, well, we can't do most of these things anymore, there are certainly a few things in here we can do, and I can't help but think that when it comes to this understanding, this is going to be a really key understanding that we're going to see play out as we look at, well, especially the things that pertain to what Yeshua did. Everything that we saw in here, with the exception of things like robbery and lying and cheating and stealing, which people tend to do, but of the things that are ultimately the kinds of things for which these offerings are made, they're all unintentional. I didn't know that these were the holy things of Yahuwah. I didn't know that something he commanded I shouldn't have done, I did. Didn't know I touched something that was dead. That's easy enough to believe. So once these things are found out, then there is a process for making them right. And of course, if it's a sin like robbery or oppression of your neighbor or something like that, not only do you make it right to them and add the fifth part to it, then you still make the other offerings.
So come out of her, O my people, for the time has come to judge Babylon. So come out of her.
Good morning, folks. Boker Tov. Shabbat Shalom. Welcome back. We are going to enter a new book this week. And this is one that, of course, people have kind of a mixed reaction to. It is often, as you, if you study from the Hebraic perspective, it's one of the books that I, by the way, have some difficulty with this, but it's what Hebrew yeshiva students start with. And, I would always suggest it's best to start at the beginning. I object to people that say start at John 1:1, the same way I would say start anywhere else other than where he chose to start. But regardless, the point is that Vayikra begins with Yahuwah called. He called unto Moshe, and he spoke to him out of the tent of meeting, and he told him a bunch of things that have to do with stuff that people will say, oh, this is all Old Testament stuff, all done away with. Sacrifices, which is zebach, or korban, which is the term for offerings. I have suggested in the past, and because the Bible uses two different words, yeah, there is a difference between a sacrifice and an offering, and those differences are important. There are some other distinctions in here, too, though, and that's where I want to focus today. In years past, I've talked about a bunch of elements of that. Some of those I will touch on today, but I'm also going to do something else because I think this morning, as I was getting prepared here, I had a number of what I think were little promptings from the Ruach suggesting titles for this one, and I'll run several of those by. The last one is probably the most succinct, but originally it had to do with the idea of vital distinctions. These are vital distinctions that I have talked about before. Unintentional sin versus intentional sin. Now, we'll talk about that. The entire Torah, I will suggest, remarks and refers to, and what we hear in Vayikra, are all kinds of things that have to do with unintentional sins. And we see various kinds of specifications, like if an anointed priest sins, if a leader or a prince, if he sins, if the whole assembly sins, if an individual in the assembly sins. But always unintentionally. And then there are remedies, things that are done that have to do with unintentional sins. Well, the distinction that I'm talking about is the thing that gets ignored. Because when you read books like Hebrew, and we will go through some of that this morning, you'll see that that word is implied, that is, if you understand it in the context of Torah, but it isn't in there, almost never. And when it really matters, it's is it intentional that they ignore the most important word? Or is it just ignorance? Or is it something worse? Well, we're going to talk about all of that today, because the difference, of course, the vital distinction between unintentional sin and deliberate sin is another word that you'll hear used when it comes to deliberate sin. It's also called rebellion. It is rebellion to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Willful sin. I know it, damn it, and I could care less what the God of the Bible says. Wait a minute, that sounds like something you hear on Sun God Day school, doesn't it? Well, they don't quite put it that way. They'll just tell you it's all done away with. And even though the guy that we claim and proclaim as Messiah, he said he wasn't going to change one yod or tittle. Well, we don't care what he says. We know better than the Messiah, don't we? We will tell him what he should have written. You know, as you've probably gathered, that attitude tends to piss me off a little bit, because I tend to think the reason why he's the Messiah and you're not, Mr. Preacher, Mr. Priest, is because he's not a liar. You call him a liar, guess which one I'm going to go with? So there are elements of that, and yes, I'll occasionally take a deep breath this morning as we go through this, but I want to suggest to people this vital distinction is really key, and the fact that it gets ignored. Once upon a time, I might have tended to ignore the fact that it was being ignored and give people the benefit of the doubt. But there's the thing that Paul says about unintentional sin. And that is, you can only claim that any particular sin is unintentional once. Well, unless you're the Biden viewer, in which case you can do it over and over again and just say, well, I left it in my diapers, I forgot. I don't know any better. But for people with half a brain, or even a third of a brain, you can't keep doing the same thing over and over again and say, I didn't know any better. Yeah, it is called insanity, and that's an excuse that many will use, and we'll probably have to address that this morning, too. But anyway, as we set this up, let's go through some of the specifics in Vayikra. I'm going to mention just a couple of things. And again, as you know, I tend to go through all of this on Erev Shabbat, Friday night. We read the whole specific Torah portion itself. It's chapters 1 through 5 of Leviticus, or Vayikra in the Hebrew. But there are a couple of things that in this context kind of leap off the page at us. Now, one, everybody knows, that is that the offering or the korban or the zebach, the sacrifice, it was to be without blemish. There are some exceptions if it's just kind of a free will offering. People just want to do it because. But on the other hand, when it's a specified thing that is going to be offered up to Yah as an olah or a chatat, it is to be without blemish. Without blemish. Well, of course, we know. Everybody says, well, that's what the Mashiach was. He was without blemish. Let me ask a question. If he was a liar and the truth was not in him, when he said, I'm not coming here to change one yod or tittle, not as long as heaven and earth still exist, and we look around and we said, well, heaven and earth still exist, but he changed his whole word. Is he without blemish? Is a so-called Messiah that could lie that bluntly, almost like he was in office in the swamp, is he without blemish? Is that a suitable sacrifice, folks? I don't know about you, but I'm going to suggest that if he's really without blemish, that's what it means, that's what it says, and that's the point here. And ironically, the same people that will ignore and call him a liar will say he's still without blemish, even though we called him a liar ourselves. So is it his own word that matters, or is it what they say he should have said if he was as smart as they think they are? Yeah, I've said that before. Now, there's another element of this that I want to point out, too. I actually mentioned this last night, and I have thought about it since then, and I'm going to suggest that there is more here than meets the eye, and having looked at it a bit deeper
and having feeling like the Ruach is showing me a couple things. I want to try to point those out and see if they don't resonate with you. That is the following. And it's kind of thing you can almost miss. And it's, again, it goes back to this idea of things that are ignored or omitted. Sometimes Torah omits things, and they are explicitly important. And that's what I'm going to suggest is true here. So, if you go to this place in chapter 4, where it says, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, all right, let's talk about some of those sins that are done in error. Error. Things that people do, and they didn't know any better. Well, at least once they can say that that's true. And in any one of the things which Yahuwah has commanded not to be done, but they somehow or other, they managed to do one of them. All right, now we got special cases. How about A? How about B? What if it's this case C here? Well, the first one says, if the anointed priest. Now, this is interesting. The use, this is the first time this word appears in the Torah, ha-mashiach. That's the article, the specific article, which the anointed thing. Well, the anointed thing is a Kohen that we're talking about here. He is a Kohen who is HaMashiach. Now, right away, a lot of Christians will be thinking, well, that's our HaMashiach. That is the high priest. Yeah, well, he can't very well claim he was doing it in ignorance, right? That wouldn't make sense. At least it doesn't to me. It might to the whole church, but because they think they know better than him anyway. Or the guy with the funny fish hat who tells him what he should have said and sits in Moses' seat and it becomes an edict, a papal edict. All right. Here's what it says, though. It says if this Kohen, who is HaMashiach, he's anointed. He has had oil put on him. He is anointed by the Creator. He's going to minister to the people in the office of Kohen, or priest. If he commits a sin, it's unintentional, says this, so that he brings guilt on the people. Well, then here's what he needs to do. How many times do you think he can get away with doing this for the same thing? Yeah, probably only the once. That's key. You can only sin unintentionally in a specific way once. What is he supposed to do? He brings... Now, I'm going to note... Let's make a table here. We'll do this because this is an oral presentation. You can't see a screen, but... there are several things this anointed Kohen is going to do. One, he brings a bull. His offering is a young bull. Oh, without blemish. It says that again. And what is he going to do with it? He brings it to the door of the tent of meeting. He lay his hands upon the head of the bull, and he kills it before Yahuwah. So the anointed Kohen does this himself. He puts his hands on the head of this animal that's going to die for his unknowing, unintentional sin. After this, it's no longer unknowing, is it? The anointed priest then takes the blood of the bullock, brings it to the tent of meeting, and the priest, the Kohen, shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle of that blood 7 times before Yahuwah in front of the veil of the sanctuary. Now, I mentioned this, and I noticed that if you go back and you look at through the rest of the things we're going to talk about here, there's only one other case where this sprinkling 7 times before Yahuwah happens. So that is the thing that I'm trying to point out and say, why? Let's think about this. This is interesting. The anointed Kohen, he brings a bull. He sprinkles the blood of the bull 7 times before Yahuwah. Same guy does the sprinkling here. Now, what's the next one? The next case that we see. If the whole congregation, the Hebrew word is kol edat, the whole congregation does something in error. Now, if you think about it, even though there might be, let's just say, a large number of communists in the crowd and people who might be swamp denizens in some places, it's kind of tough to imagine all of them being in ignorance more than once. Now, you can imagine mob rule and mob effects. Yeah, that's a different set of psychologies, and there you go. We're talking about that later. But the whole congregation, if they all err, and as one body, the thing is hid from the eyes of the assembly. Notice that makes it a little bit harder. That's a higher burden, isn't it? To do any of the things which Yahuwah has commanded is not to be done, and they did it, they're guilty. And then the sin that they have done becomes known. Now it's no longer unknown, it's no longer unintentional, but they're sorry about it maybe. Then the assembly does what? Isn't this interesting? They offer a young bull, same as the priest. Young bull for a sin offering, they bring it before the tent of the meeting. Now it's the elders, the leaders, if you will, those that are supposedly in authority of the congregation, the edat, that lay their hands on the head of the bull before Yahuwah, and it is killed before Yahuwah. And then guess what? The anointed priest. Now, is this the same one? Well, no, he's learned better, but maybe the same guy. But anyway, whoever it is, that it is the Kohen HaMashiach, he brings the blood of the bull, to the tent of meeting. He dips his anointed priest's finger into the blood. He sprinkles it 7 times before Yahuwah in front of the veil. 7 times before Yahuwah. Now, we know a couple things about this number 7. It's the number of completion. That does certainly fit here, doesn't it? He puts the blood, now this is done in every case. He puts the blood on the horns of the altar, which is before Yahuwah, in the tent of meeting. He pours out the rest at the base of the altar of burnt offering in the door, and then they do the thing where they make the fat smoke, and there's a description there. And then after that, the remains are carried outside and burned outside the camp. Now, if you go back and look at the rest of them that follow, here is when the Nasi, the ruler or the prince, when he sins, he does do error, which is something commanded not to be done, and he is guilty. Well, he, in fact, puts his hands upon the goat, and they kill it in the place where the burnt offering is before Yahuwah. But notice, priest takes the blood of the sin offering with his finger, puts it on the horns of the altar. There's none of this sprinkling 7 times thing. How about the next one? If any one of the common people of the land, people of Kol Edah, they do something, be-shagaga, in error, anything which Yahuwah has commanded not to be done, well, same thing. This person who has done the sin, now he brings an offering, just like the prince, by the way, a goat. Now, the offering that the prince brought was a male goat, a he-goat, without blemish. Now the guy who has sinned just among the regular crowd, he brings a female goat without blemish. Notice, still without blemish. And again, he lays his hand upon the head, and it's killed. And the priest, the Kohen, same type of Kohen anyway, takes the blood on his finger, doesn't sprinkle it says. Just says he puts it on the horns of the altar, and he pours out the rest at the base. And then they make the fat smoke. And also tells us that it could be a female without blemish of the lambs as opposed to of the goats. So what do we got here? We got the sprinkling 7 times thing, which seems to be a distinction. In every case, we're talking about someone or some group that sins without knowing that they sinned. I'll say it again, because guess what? We're going to talk about this in a bit more detail. It's kind of hard to claim that somebody sins and does the same thing again the second time without knowing. What do they do? If it is, in fact, the anointed Kohen, they bring a bull. If it is the whole congregation, they bring a bull. And in this case, it's the leaders that put their hands on the head. And the anointed Kohen, one way or the other, he sprinkles the blood 7 times. So it looks to me, this is kind of what I'm trying to suggest here, somehow there's a difference. There is an extra thing, an extra level, this dip and sprinkle 7 times, that's required when it is either an anointed Kohen or the whole congregation. Let me just, now, here comes a little bit of markology. I'm asking, what is the difference? What kind of immediately comes to mind? Now, again, we do not see this explicitly in Scripture. I will say, if you read this, it's kind of hard for me not to see it, but there you go. This is my connection of the dots, so it's markology, if you will. I think in either case, the anointed Kohen should be expected to know better. Isn't he a Kohen? Isn't he supposed to know and teach the instruction of the Creator? Okay, maybe he just missed it. Hey, we all make mistakes. We all learn. Fine. How about the whole congregation? Well, out of the whole congregation, for every one of them to have been duped, that's a higher burden, right? A higher hurdle. So it looks to me like the higher hurdle involves this 7x sprinkling thing before Yahuwah. And in both cases, it's a bull, too. And as you know, bulls are generally considered to be more expensive, more valuable. This is a more costly sacrifice than a goat or a lamb might be, even a female goat or a lamb. So let's ask a question, and then I'm going to go ahead and we're going to talk about some of the reading from Hebrews that goes with this. Now, there's a couple things about this that I find particularly interesting, and yeah, even a little bit irritating. We'll come back to that. Hebrews is one of those books that that people who aren't Hebrews and don't know anything about the Torah will always turn to say, see, the Torah doesn't matter. And see, you know, as if by not knowing about the Torah, we could read this book out of context and make a claim that it somehow or other buttresses our points of ignorance. Color me skeptical on that score. All right. So let's talk about Hebrews. Let's talk about some of the distinctions within and now as well.
So as you know, there have been readings for a long time that people put together. Mostly these would be messianic preachers and so forth. I'm going to add one other element in here in a couple minutes, because there are some preachers that, let's just say, I don't have great respect for. That would include those that say the law is done away with, and we call the Mashiach himself a liar and claim that the truth is not in him because he did away with the law when he said he wasn't gonna. But hey, that's okay, because we know better than he did what he should have written. And he needed to correct some things, and if he didn't, we're going to correct them for him, even if heaven and earth still exist. So let's talk about one of those places. Now, one of the readings that you'll see, I've got one of the books here that looks at some of the messianic understandings. And it's, by the way, in case you're curious, I reference it fairly frequently. It's called A Year Through the Torah, A Week-by-Week Journey for Christians, written by John J. Parsons. And generally, it's pretty good. I've had some Jewish friends that were very Hebrew literate that are Torah scholars that have looked at it and said, yeah, this ain't bad, especially for a Christian. Now, there are some places where all of us would take issue. I would say that is true, too. One of them is in this reading for today, which is Hebrews chapter 10. Now, is it all of Hebrews chapter 10? No, it's just verses 1 of chapter 10 through 18. And what I think is kind of interesting is the rubber meets the road a few verses after they quit reading. Isn't that funny? And we'll come back to that. So I want to go through some of this. Again, this is the part that you will hear oftentimes taught on Sun God Day when they say, we don't keep his Sabbath anymore, you know, the one that he said to keep forever throughout your generations and all your dwelling places. Why? Because he didn't change it, so we did. What are we claiming? Well, remember how the popes got around to changing it. They claimed we have the apostolic succession. So we are the vicars of Christ who come, and we put on our funny hat that's modeled after Dagon, right? Poseidon, the fish god. That doesn't matter. Don't pay no attention to that man in the funny hat. Well, pay no attention to the funny hat. But anyway, and we're going to change his Sabbath. We got rid of some of his Moedim, his appointed times. We like ours better. We got these pagan things. We'll tell you that we've Christianized Christmas and Ishtar and bunnies and eggs and you name it. So back to chapter 10 here. Chapter 10 is another one of these really interesting ones, and I'm gonna read it as written in the New King James, and then I'll correct a few of the obvious things you probably are know about. First one, for the law, the nomos in the Greek, does nomos mean the same as Torah? No, it does not. Okay, nomos just means whatever the hell we call law today. Man's law, God's law, we don't really know, we don't care to make a distinction, it's just nomos, don't you know? The law, having a shadow of the good things to come. Now, is it possible Paul was talking about the Torah here? If so, that has been lost in multiple levels of translation. So what we need to do is be real careful about context. And in fact, if we're careful to read this in context, by the way, some will contend that Paul wrote Hebrews. I don't, quite frankly. I'll admit that it's a possibility. Maybe somebody else edited it. But there are some big differences with the style that other scholars, and I don't consider myself enough of a style scholar to be able to make the claim. But I can read this, and it sure doesn't sound like the same guy that wrote all those other letters in certain respects. So here we go. Whoever wrote it, the author of Hebrews says, for the law, the nomos, having a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very image of those things, can never, with those same sacrifices, is that word zabak there, or is it something different? It's a Greek word, obviously. We don't know what the Hebrew was. Which they offer continually, year by year, make those who approach perfect. So, if we're offering these sacrifices, that's not going to make anybody perfect. Well, I don't have any argument with that. That seems pretty clear. Because that's what he's going to say. If that was true, then why do they keep doing it? For then they would have ceased to be offered, would they not? For these worshipers, once purified, would no more have consciousness of sins. Now we stop. They no more have consciousness of sins. Is it just possible that there's one word here that in context makes perfect sense, but out of context changes the whole meaning? I'm going to suggest the answer is yeah. Would they have not ceased to have been offered? Well, there's one requirement. That is, these sacrifices, and it says it over and over again, they are offered for unintentional sins. Now, there are offerings, like the morning lamb and the evening lamb, that are just plain offerings. They're not supposed to take away sin. They're just basically saying, here they are. The creator of the universe says, offer this in the morning, offer this in the evening. One of the things that happens is, the Kohen gets to eat. The food for the priests and his house is because of these morning and evening lambs. All right, so the worshipers, though once purified, would they not have any more consciousness of what? unintentional sin. Now see, I'm going to just say, doesn't this make perfect sense? If you just step back and say it, it kind of is so obvious that once you see it, you can't unsee it. If they were unintentional sins before, and now we have to offer something because of our unintentional sin, put our hand on the head of this poor animal is going to die for us, maybe that makes an emotional impact. Just maybe I'll remember that. Maybe I'll come around next time I get ready to make that same unintentional sin and say, oops, no, I can't claim it's unintentional because I know damn well better. I know better. It's not, I'm not going to do that anymore because it's no longer unintentional. So would they not have then ceased to have been offered? Sure. No point in it because they're no longer unintentional. I can't help but think, you know, all you got to do is just look at this stuff, understand the Torah, and presumably the author of Hebrews, writing to Hebrews, would suspect that his readers would have that understanding. Now, if they're sun god day types and they've never heard this Torah and they're told it's done away with and they don't even make the distinction, maybe a mistranslation can slide right on by. But, he says, in those things, there's a reminder of sins every year, because it's not possible for the blood of goats and bulls to take away sins. No, it's not. Now, people make a big deal about covering up sins. It's about making atonement. But remember, the blood of the bulls and the goats, I don't care how you phrase it, does it take away the sins? Does it allow us to become in unity, right? Because in the shedding of blood, there is remission of sin. Somebody puts their hand on the head of this poor bull or goat or lamb, and it's going to die in your stead. And the blood is shed. It doesn't take away the sin, but it sure as hell takes away the reminder, the failure at least, to recognize that it was unintentional. Again, it cannot be unseen. Once we have that dramatic demonstration that we should have known better, now we do, doesn't it seem obvious that it's no longer required? And it can't take away the sin, especially if you keep doing it and claim I didn't know any better. Okay? So, herefore they quote Psalm 40, and it says, he said the following, sacrifice and offering you do not desire, but a body you have prepared for me. This sounds like a reference to the Mashiach, right? And burnt offerings, and that would be Olah, and in Chatat, sacrifices for sin, you had no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I've come in the volume of the book. It is written of me to do your will, O Elohim. And I've said this before, too. Isn't it interesting, that turn of phrase, the volume of the book? Because the volume of the Torah, the volume of the book, is about him. It's about the Mashiach, no question about that. And as I like to point out, if you look at all these references to unintentional sin and the kinds of things that are being done, they paint a picture. And they paint a picture because what is missing is the singular sacrifice for rebellion, for intentional, deliberate, knowing rebellion to the Creator of the universe. There's only one way for that to be made right. And that is the one we're talking about here. That's the key distinction that is ignored. And it's got to do with unintentional sin versus rebellion. Okay? He's come saying, behold, I will do your will, O Elohim. He takes away the first that he may establish the second. He takes away the unintentional that he might establish the ability to have a right relationship, even in the presence of intentional, deliberate rebellion. That is, if we do what? Make teshuvah. Turn, repent, realize that we should not have done that. Now we've been caught. What is my rightful service? To do it again no more. To truly turn. If you love me, keep my commandments. By that all we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of the Mashiach, Yahushua, once. Once. Now, if you've got a Bible there, King James, New King James, notice that at the end of that sentence, there's two little words that are in italics. Once for all. Do I buy that? Those words are added. The fact that they're in italics means they were not in the original text. We have been sanctified through the offering of the body of HaMashiach Yahushua, salvation of Yah, once. Once. Period. End of story. I can't help but think that that's actually closer to the truth than those extra words which supposedly add understanding, but no, they don't. They obfuscate the singular truth, and they help cover up the fact that there's a distinction, and it's vital, between knowing deliberate rebellion
and unintentional sin, which you can't keep doing and say that it's still unintentional. Every priest, every Kohen, it says, stands ministering daily and offering repeatedly these same sacrifices, which can never take away, can I put the word in? Intentional sins. Of course they can't. They're not intended to. It says so in plain sight, print. These same sacrifices are for unintentional sins. They cannot, will not do, take away intentional sins. Now the next line makes more sense. But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, including the ones that paint by, removal of what's not obvious, rebellion, he sat down at the right hand of Elohim. From that time waiting till his enemies are made his footstool. For by one offering he has perfected forever those who are being sanctified, set apart. But the Holy Spirit, the Ruach, also witnesses to us after he'd said before, this is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, says Yahuwah. I will put my Torot, my instructions, plural, not laws. It includes laws, but it's bigger than that, folks. And if you have it in your heart, you'll know that. I will put my Torot into their hearts, and in their minds will I write them. And then he says, their sins and their Torahless deeds will I remember no more. Now listen to this, and I'm going to correct it as I read it. Verse 18, again, same word is left out, but it fits. Notice, now, when there is remission of these, there is no longer an offering for sin. What's the word? Intentional sin. Okay, it's no longer unintentional. He's done it. If it was unintentional, then there would be another offering for unintentional sin. But if it's intentional sin, and he's done it, well, you know, there's another place, we'll talk about that, where he says, don't put him to death again on the cross. And we're going to hear it in this portion, in this part of Hebrews as well. Only Elohim can change the past is something I wrote in my margin a long, long time ago. And that's true, folks. If he has forgotten our sins, he's literally rewritten it, expunged it from the timeline. That is truly a major big deal. But as far as us humans are concerned, we can only sin unintentionally once. And when we understand that vital distinction and notice that those words are just left out of here when they matter most, probably because if the author really did understand he was writing about Hebrews to Hebrews, they would have known this. Okay. Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Yeshua, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil, that is his flesh, and now having a Kohen Hagadol over the Beit Yah, the house of Elohim, let's draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled 7 times from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let's hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised us is faithful. Lots of good stuff here. And by the way, the portion, the official part that the essentially the messianic versions would say quit, they quit after verse 18. How there's no longer an offering for sin. Is it unintentional? Is it intentional? Again, the difference is key. They quit. But I'm going to read on, okay? So let's consider one another in order to stir up love and good works and not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. How about we do it on the right day? Does that matter? It's funny because people say, well, you got to go to church on Sun God Day. Well, fine. I don't care where you go on Sun God Day, but let's keep and remember and set apart and honor his Sabbath, which is the 7th day because he says so. And he said he wasn't changing it. And he said it's forever. And he said it's throughout your generations, wherever you live, in the land or out. Exhorting one another, especially as you see the day. What day? Maybe the day we're talking about coming up soon, approaching. Now, here it is, verse 26, and this is the one I want to spend the time on. It's the one that is not part of most of the readings, and maybe we're seeing why. But listen to this, because now there is, in fact, that word in here. It's the only place where that distinction is not ignored, except maybe we just got to read it properly in context. Verse 26, chapter 10. For if we sin willfully, now here it is, the author's coming right out and saying it. If we sin willfully after we have received the knowledge of the truth, Well, guess what? You can't claim it's unintentional. There no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, unintentional or intentional. Because the sacrifice, folks, is for unintentional sins. Those don't exist anymore once we've one by one recognized that they were, well, they were wrong and we can't do them again because they're no longer unintentional, which leaves only intentional, which leaves only, are we rebelling against Him or not? If we have knowledge of the truth, if we've come to Him and we say, yes, I have accepted Him as my Mashiach, well, why do you call me Lord, Lord, He says, and not do what I say? If we sin willfully after we have received the knowledge of the truth, there is no longer, this is not a surprise, is it? There's no longer a remaining sacrifice for sins. Now, Paul gets a little bit more blunt here even than sometimes I do. But a certain fearful expectation of judgment and fiery indignation, which will devour the adversaries. Ha-satan, the adversary singular or plural. Ha-satanim, I guess. Anyone who has rejected the Torah of Moses, it says, dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Notice he uses that in the present tense. Isn't that funny? Let me read that again. If the law's done away with, what is this? What are we saying here? No, that can't be right. No, we used to kill people for doing things that, you know, were blasphemous or that were outlawed in His word, like violation of the Sabbath. Not anymore. We kill them if they don't eat Easter Sun God Day pig, maybe, for the Inquisition. Maybe we'll burn them at the stake. Anyone who has rejected the Torah of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Present tense. Interesting. Of how much worse penalty and punishment do you think will he who does this be thought worthy of, who has trampled the Son of Elohim underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified, a common, a base, thrown away, a worthless thing, and even insulted the Ruach of grace, the Ruach HaKodesh. Well, you know what Yeshua said? Blasphemy against the Ruach HaKodesh. That's the only unforgivable sin. Are we talking something similar here? This is the author of Hebrews. May or may not be Paul, but Paul said similar things. So in this case, maybe it's not as big of a difference. But I can't help but think the use of the present tense, this is written after, right, after the death of Mashiach. Still dies on the testimony without mercy of two or three witnesses. And how much worse do you think it is for somebody who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, called the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified a common, a base, a worthless thing, and insulted the Ruach on top of that? How about calling him a liar? How about saying his law is done away with? How about saying, I don't give a damn how many times you sin? Okay, just you know, plead the blood and give me that get-out-of-hell pre-card you got right there. And you don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to keep my word. You don't have to keep my commandments. You can call me Lord, Lord all you want. Now what does he say? His path is narrow. Few there be that find it. He also says furthermore that, there'll be a whole lot of people come to me in that day saying, Lord, Lord, didn't we do all this stuff in your supposed name? Cast out demons in your name? What will I hear? What will he tell them, he says? Depart from me, you who are without Torah. You who work lawlessness. I never knew you. Once you begin to see this, and the distinctions that have been ignored, when we recognize that they're in there because of context, it's just that letters written by Hebrews to Hebrews that are interpreted by people who don't give a squat, don't know, and are ignorant, and then take out the words that matter, or just ignore that they were ever even supposed to be there, can come to a completely different conclusion than the right one. What does Paul say? You in a whole heap of trouble. He hadn't done yet. The author of Hebrews says, for we know him, they capitalize it in the English, who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And again, Yahuwah will judge his people. One more time. It is a fearful thing, says the author of Hebrews, to fall into the hands of the living God. It's interesting. Okay, there's a whole lot more here. You recall the former days when you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, you've been made a spectacle of. So he's reminding people of the fact that we've all had difficulties and we've come through a lot of that and here we are at this place. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that after you've done the will of Elohim, you may receive the promise.
for yet a little while. He who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. That sounds serious too. But we, concludes the author here on the end of chapter 10, and we're going to get a slight different change of pace in chapter 11, so okay, maybe this is a good break. Sometimes the chapter markings come at the right place in your host's opinion here, in my opinion, maybe not always. But anyway, in this case, but we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the nephesh. What is it we're trying to recognize? What is it he's saying? There really is a vital distinction between unintentional sin and intentional sin, and an understanding what it is that it means to come without blood, without blemish, and that the shedding of blood is important for the remission of sins. And this idea of the double sprinkling, let me go back and touch on that again, having just looked at this place in Hebrews. I'll say it again. The anointed Cohen, he should know better. After this, he certainly does. He knows with respect to that one thing that he got wrong and didn't ought to have done, but he did, not to do it. And he sprinkled seven times before Yahuwah the blood of the sacrifice that represents his having learned the hard way about one specific element that he didn't think was important, but now he knows is. And somebody else died for him. Isn't that interesting? How about the whole congregation? Well, with the whole congregation, and it's hidden from all of their eyes, you got to figure that should be a pretty high burden too. Well, unless just maybe they go to church on Sunday, God Day School, and they hear a bunch of whore priests for another Jesus whom we've not preached, lying to them and convincing them that none of this crap matters, and the law's all done away with, and all that really matters is get your, say your get out of hell free card. Say your prayer and get your get out of hell free card. If you get the idea that there's some disdain here, that I have a little difficulty with those who, I guess Paul just pointed out, are deserving of the wrath of Elohim and are in fact die without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses, those that Yeshua said who are teaching, who should be held to a higher standard, they knew or should have known better, is the modern legal parlance. They can't very well claim it's unintentional, or they can, or can they? All right, I had this discussion this morning. This is ironic. Some of the folks here in the room don't know this, but after I got done milking the goats and I went back upstairs and I looked online, I saw another reference to the clergy response teams. Isn't that topical? Clergy response teams right here. So I printed this out, and a lot of folks I know, most everybody that's probably on site here has heard about the clergy response teams. I will contend that these are the ministers of whoring Satan. Isn't that a little bit blunt? You damn right it is. And that's the explicit reference that I'm going to make for people that are essentially driving his people to places that bring death and destruction and teaching that things that he says carry a death penalty, they're done away with. I think probably that I'm being a little too kind to them. But regardless, clergy response team. If you have not heard about this, the idea is that some of the evil three-letter agencies, FEMA and the DHS and others, got together literally, it's been at least 20 years ago so that I can remember having first heard about this, and essentially said, let's go corrupt some of the clergy, priests and pastors and potentates and others who are in positions of authority to lie to their flocks. Some of the greatest evils the government has come up with yet. Who are these people? Well, the CRT, Clergy Response Team, as it was called, originally was to have a pastor who was respected by his local sheeple. And when Big Brother needs to, they call him up and they say, hey, pull out that Romans 13 speech that we gave you and trot that out again. Because we need more local help to retain law and order. Actually, imitation law, remember? A law in violation of the Constitution is no law. A law that is in contrast to his written word, his instruction, that's no law either. But they tell the pastor that he and his family, they'll get special passes, guarantees, food. Maybe they get a little ticket to the down under, deep underground military bases, travel passes, and we need your help during times of emergencies. Emergencies we've got planned, we're starting to trot out. We saw one of them during COVID. We're going to see more. Then the hooks come out. They tell the pastor, because of the need for security, you can't share any of the stuff we're telling you. So you need to sign this NDA, this non-disclosure agreement. Turns out, from what I've seen, there are multiple levels of it. It's kind of like the multiple levels of the Masonic Lodge, right? You get initiated, and then you get a little bit more secret stuff. And you get your secret decoder ring, and we're going to tell you what the real truth is. Eventually, whether it's Masons or the clergy, I guess, maybe at some point they tell them, hey, you know, have you figured out yet who we're really serving? Hint, hint. It's not the God that wrote the Bible, because if you'd noticed, we don't want you talking about that Bible thing when we get ready to do our work anyway. Then they indoctrinate the pastor to talk about Romans 13. And I have done Romans 13 so many times that I'm honestly tired of it. If you will read it, if you will simply read, let every soul be subject to the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. Now, which God are we talking about? See, therein lies the rub. Is it the God of this world? That's what they seem to be talking about. Or is it the one that wrote the book? It turns out that even in the Greek, and we don't know what the original Hebrew was, but the Greek word there is exousia. And whoever resists this exousia resists the ordinance of Elohim, and they that do resist will receive damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Now, the question is, who defines good and who defines evil? Hint. It's not the one that wrote the Bible in the case of those that are preaching this Romans 13 interpretation. If you look at exousia, you'll see that exousia is not literally the power that comes from Elohim. It is the higher liberty, is another way to put it. And it's kind of funny, because if you think about it, those whom he has made free are free indeed, kind of fits. So there is a real twisting. If you just take Romans 13 there and change that word that is in the Greek, it can use a concordance, pull up the word, see where the word exousia is, look and see that exousia has other definitions, pull out another one, like liberty, and stick it in there in place of wherever that word exousia is in the verse and read it. Let every soul be subject to the higher liberty. For there is no liberty, but of Elohim, and the powers that are ordained are of Elohim. For whoever resists the liberty resists the ordinance of Elohim, and they that resist will receive to themselves damnation. Suddenly, that just puts a whole different spin on it, doesn't it? Okay? And restore to whom their due. Tribute to whom tribute is due. Gee, is that Big Brother? Is that HaSatan, or is it the creator of the universe? And who do they serve? Yeshua says, hey, we can tell. By their fruit you shall know them. Fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Do we honor? Does the clergy response team, do they honor Satan? Do they honor the adversary, or do they honor the Creator? By their fruit you shall know them. Okay, you don't have to go through a whole lot of other stuff. Chuck Baldwin and others, and I respect Chuck Baldwin, he has some teachings on it, which I think are generally pretty sound. They don't go exactly the same places. I'd say we're probably about 80% on the same page that I do. But nevertheless, there's a whole lot of ways you can look at Romans 13 as preached, right? You know what I refer to, the government-inspired version, the GIV, and it really boils down to when Big Brother says jump, you say, yes, Master, how high? It's that simple. Now, there's some other stuff. I'm looking at several pieces here. This one in particular talks about when it's time, pastor gets to the higher levels of indoctrination. He passes the background checks. He's authored a step up. He can become the next level of ruler in hell and so forth. And notice that some of them will admit, hey, we talk less and less about Jesus. Well, you know, if you actually got his real name right, that's a red herring. The question is, are you talking about the Mashiach, or are you talking about the one who pretends to be him on this earth? That's the difference. And when it comes time for the roundup of all the so-called Christians, the clergy response team pastors will be the ones leading their own flock off to torture and death in the government indoctrination centers, death camps, and of course in the Zyklon B showers. They're already showing that they can preach the Zyklon B doctrine, and we had the Supreme Court looking at that this week. All the time quoting Romans 13. You know, jump. Big Brother says jump. Bottom line, don't believe it. Now, I do think it's interesting because you'll hear this admonishment from most of the people who see through it. I will point out that Heal Our Land Ministries and Peter Kershaw and others have identified that one of the connections is the 501c3 church, the idea of, cross my palm with silver, selling out for a little filthy lucre. It's whoring, folks. That's exactly what it is. That's why, here we don't do the 501c3 thing because there are strings attached. But regardless, I think the clergy response team and the 501c3 are kind of like twin sisters of the same whore. Okay. So what you'll hear is you'll hear people say, hey, you want to ask? tell your pastor that if he is a member of the clergy and he believes that Bible thing, which he doesn't, then he must speak the truth to you if you ask him. Will he? Probably not, because he doesn't serve the same master. That master, and the Torah's done away with, right? The law's done away with. Hell, there's no problem for him lying. If he refuses to reply, though, to the straight-out question, are you a member of the clergy response team? Are you? Are you? Huh? Huh? Well, if he refuses to reply, that's kind of like an answer. How about if he says he is? Well, then just say, adios. I'm out of here. No more. And I'm not going to have anything to do with the people who are stupid enough to believe your crap, either. By the way, if he says, read Romans 13, you got the same answer and the same response. And I can't help but note, I've seen this, a couple more interesting statistics. One, and I remember when this son of a bitch, and I'm using that kindly, Marcus Wolf, he was actually head of the East German Stasi. Marcus Wolf was the guy who put the East German Stasi tactics in place to spy and infiltrate. Remember, the walls have ears in East Germany after the wall. And he controlled the churches there and got people to rat out their neighbors and so forth. Well, he was hired to come over here and set up the DHS after 9/11. What a wonderful, oh-so-satanic thing. We got to have the best people to help put the best German and SS and Stasi crap in place. All right, there's a factoid. I cannot confirm this, but I have seen it, and certainly it comports with what I suspect to be the case, so I'll mention it. There are claims, let me just put it that way, again, unverified, that of the 501c3 or of the whore church pastors, priests in the United States, fully two-thirds are members of the clergy response team. So odds are that especially if he's making big bucks and got a Gulfstream, he's probably a member of the CRT. This claim I've heard more times than I can count, that when the time comes, when the word is given, families in the church on a given Sunday, on any given Sunday, you know it'll be on a Sunday, don't you? That's when they'll have the best harvest here. They'll split up the husbands, the wives, the children, put them all into separate buses, take them to the assigned pickup points, the termination camps, and that'll be the end of it. They'll never see each other again. Nobody will ever see them again. And what, is that the end of the story? No, but it certainly is at least a beginning. And by the way, there'll be some of these LGBTQ types and their pastors and others all in the camps, and they'll be keeping people in line. Be good little Christians here in the camps. And you're never going to see your wife and children again, but hey, maybe if you go get yourself a shower over there, see that little shower down at the end of the wall there? Pay no attention to those naked people walking into the ditch, but go get your shower, and then maybe you can see your wife. That may be the closest they get to telling you the truth. How's that for irony? All right, I hope it's clear where I'm headed here, because I'm going to try to make as clear of a connection as I can. Am I going to suggest, and the answer is you're darn right I am, that the same people who knew or should have known that are in fact committing deliberate rebellion to the creator of the universe, whoring in response to service to Ha-Satan, the prince of this world, are they walking in rebellion to the creator, and that there therefore remains no more sacrifice for intentional rebellion to God? Are they deserving of exactly the wrath that the author of Hebrews points out? I tell you what, I can honestly say I won't shed a tear. I'm sick and tired of hearing people call the one true Son of God a liar and say he did away with the law. It just plain pisses me off. It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. We know him who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says Yahuwah, and Yahuwah will judge his people. How much worse do you think it'll be than just dying on the testimony of two or three witnesses for violating Torah? Will those who trample the Son of Elohim underfoot, count the blood of his covenant, by which you were allegedly sanctified, a trivial, common, base thing, and insult the Ruach Elohim? He said it. I'm just reading it. And it's funny, isn't it? They will just love to quote Hebrews, take it out of context, but when it hits home, then we don't hear about that one. That particular verse, again, isn't in so many of the readings that people are supposed to pay attention to. I find that ironic, to put it mildly. Now, what I want to do next is I'm going to just talk about a couple of other things. I don't as often on the Sabbath talk about so many of the things that are going on in the world, But this last week, there have been so many that were just in your face, unbelievable, that I think we got to run through there. And let's see, let me work up to this one. And I'll start with this piece. This is from James Howard Kunstler. I like Jim Kunstler's work. And he says, can you feel it? He calls this piece Wake Up Call. The tension is rising to the red line. It runs clear through all of Western civilization. We're ruled by a government of fiends. But now the sun rides higher in the sky. The sap is rising in the northern forest. The earth heaves. The buds swell and blush. Something's in the air. Animals are waking from their long winter sleep. The natives are restless. And we've moved on from the two traditional political divisions, liberal and conservative. They died with the COVID-1984 pandemic. Now, there are simply two different parties, peoples, the sane versus the insane. And by the way, he says the sane have just plain had enough of being pushed around by the insane. The insane don't care what reality tries to tell them. They got a bunch of insanity to protect. They call themselves progressive, which is a sign of their insanity. Progress towards what? More insanity? They don't believe any of the theoretical bullshit they force you to swallow. They don't care about climate change. It's just a cudgel they use to beat everyone else so they can steal your stuff. They don't care about democracy. And here's another story. I'll jump out of sequence here. I kid you not, this is true. It's going to be one of the last ones I was going to do today. In a challenge in the District of Criminals, a judge, Amy Berman Jackson, have we heard that name? She'll probably be on the Supreme Court here soon. She, an appointee of Barack Hussein Obama, found that a group of seven citizens who had tried to sue to prevent non-citizens from voting in the swamp and running for office, they lacked standing to challenge the legislation. Isn't that funny? You citizens, you lack standing. But them illegals, they can come and vote and run for office and take over and throw your asses out of here. Ha ha! But you lack standing. Folks, this would be funny if it wasn't so, well, insane. And they talked about self-government by the people, and the answer is, you people ain't the people anymore. And if you hadn't figured that out yet, you're gonna, the hard way. Okay, back to Jim Kunstler. No, they don't believe in democracy. They don't care about public health. They don't care about the rule of law. They use lawfare. They're stealing stuff. Again, so what, right? Are we surprised? Hell no. How about this one? There was a huge attack in Moscow overnight. If you hadn't heard about this, it's worth checking out. More will come about it, no doubt. Initial reports, though, were, I saw originally 100 and some odd people killed, and as of a few minutes just before I went live here this morning, the number was up to 143 and counting. 143 people killed in a deadly terror attack at a concert hall in Krasnogorsk, just northwest of Moscow on late Friday. This comes days after, get this, the American embassy in Russia warned Americans to be wary of coming mass terror attacks at mass events. So Jack Posobiec and a whole lot of others are saying, doesn't this just kind of stink to high heaven? Could it be the CIA that's involved there? That's what Moscow is saying. Moscow is demanding, why is it that U.S. intelligence knew there was going to be an imminent attack on Moscow? And now they're claiming ISIS-K did it, a branch of the group, get this, and this is embarrassing to the Weidenfuhrer. This is a branch of a terrorist group in Afghanistan, wielding all kinds of weapons that were, guess what? Maybe they were provided to them by the Weidenfuhrer when we withdrew from Afghanistan list. I guess all they didn't do was use attack helicopters funded by U.S. taxpayers. Anyway, everybody knew there was going to be an attack, at least all the intelligence agencies in the swamp did, on Moscow, according to officials. And ISIS has now, they've captured, Moscow claims they've captured 11 terrorists and maybe more. But that was what I saw most recently. And they are admitting that they were paid. These were paid assassins. And they're claiming that ISIS-K was behind it. I don't know what K stands for. Maybe K Street in Washington. But anyway, call it yet another really, really stinky thing that is indicating to people that are paying attention, they're trying to push Moscow to attacking NATO or worse. How about this one? This is just this last week. It's about the 10th of these things I've seen. CIA has come out and, well, no, they have been ratted out. And this is Jim Jordan of Ohio, James Comer of Kentucky. They have not one but two whistleblowers who have brought them information which corroborates their concerns that, quote, the CIA directly interfered with DOJ and IRS investigations of none other than the big guy's first meddler and enforcer, Hunter Biden, and his laptop. These are the same intelligence officials, remember, that lied and said, you don't get to see that laptop. It's what? Russian disinfo. CIA intervened in the investigation of Hunter Biden to prevent the IRS and DOJ from interviewing witnesses. And they named the witness, and basically they deviated, the DOJ deviated from their own standard processes. Thank you, Merrick Garland. Are we surprised? Okay. Got one more here. Here's a funny one. This would be funny, I guess, if it wasn't just so Clinton-esque. There was a fellow who is the director, executive director, of the Bill and Hillary Clinton National Airport in Little Rock, Arkansas. Okay, now you got to wonder, what did he know? When did he know it? He's been shot dead. They don't even claim this is Arkansas. This is the new version of Arkansas, I guess. And Alex Jones said this about it. Very strange. We need to look into this. Yeah, you think? Basically, he was shot dead by Big Brother's government agents by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms during a raid on his home. They busted down his dorm, blew that son of a you-know-what away. Guy's name was Brian Malinowski. They accused him of breaking federal firearms laws. Well, no, they're not laws. They're ordinances that do not have the force of law because they're unconstitutional. He sold guns without a license, and they executed him right there on the spot. They could have done any number of other things, say his surviving relatives. ATF bursts into his house in a manner that was most dangerous. Why? Why not wait till he gets in his car? Arrest him. Arrest him somewhere else. Nope. By the way, the search warrant that used to justify the raid, the family says it looks bogus. So even if the allegations are true, said the attorneys representing the body, they don't begin to justify what happened. At worst, Brian Malinowski, gun owner and gun enthusiast, stood accused of making private firearm sales to a person, and they killed him for it. Yep, doesn't quite pass the smell test. Swamp wins. Senate approves a House sellout. So you got two of the same wings of the bird of prey flapping in unison. $1.2 trillion more spending, more DEI, more abortion, more trannies, no border enforcement. This is during the same week that border at El Paso was literally overrun by mobs of terrorists and military-aged males and so forth. 25 rhinos agreed in the Senate. And in the House, basically, there's a whole bunch of rhinos and sellouts. 1,012 page bill. And somebody asked, did any of them actually read the whole thing? You know they didn't. It's passed. And Speaker Mike Johnson is maybe going to get vacated, says Marjorie Taylor Greene. Good riddance. You know, he's basically shown that he ain't no better than any of the other ones. And one more, and then I'll kind of begin to wrap some of the ribbons around the conclusion here. Emissions are not a material risk to investors or companies, says a piece from Zero Hedge, Real Clear Wire, and others. What's happened is the Securities and Exchange Commission has issued a new rule for U.S. companies. If you weren't uncompetitive before, you will be now. It's called the Climate Disclosure Rule. So they're going to make companies spend who knows how many millions of bucks, hit another whacker on the GDP, and approve, this was approved in a partisan vote, and it says basically you must show the direct and indirect emissions to investors as part of the reports. And the idea is to baffle them with bullshit, right? Overwhelm investors with information unrelated to actual risks of a company's financial performance. So the critics are saying, what are the emissions coming from a company's truck have to do with an investment that is risky to investors? Answer, well, we know this. And they down here, they say it. The risk is that policymakers may intervene. The actual risk, we saw it this week, folks. Big Brother may just come and steal your company if you do something politically incorrect. Letitia James is going to steal Trump's buildings. And now the SEC is saying, if you don't reveal to us how much non-malicious CO2 your company's putting out, we'll steal your company. There's the risk to investors about bogus climate BS. So, again, is it a crime to lie to people? Can you keep on lying and claim that I was ignorant, I didn't know? Are we seeing, in fact, kind of what happens when a whole nation runs afoul of this idea that they keep sinning, they sin intentionally, they get caught, they say, the hell with you and the horse you rode in on, ha ha, you can't stop us, we're going to double down and do it more. And I'm going to say exactly what Paul did. So it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living Elohim. May it be so. Finally, if you hadn't seen it, we had this week. The Supreme Court, I almost have to say sick after that, they had an oral argument session where they basically brought in the traitors that are on the defense here. The case is called Missouri versus Biden, or Murphy v. Missouri. Remember, it was appealed all the way up several ladders, so more than one name applying to this. Missouri versus Biden, I think, is the one that probably is most apropos. But essentially, you have the case, and we've all seen it, right? The Twitter files, Elon Musk, it's part of the reason why he bought Twitter, to Facebook, various socialist media platforms. They literally went out and they, to use the Godfather analogy, because it's so true, they made them an offer they couldn't refuse. They told Amazon, they told Facebook, they told Twitter, don't you dare tell people about ivermectin. Don't you dare print anything that Big Brother doesn't want them to know. That ivermectin will prevent them from what it is that we're going to jam their blood and their veins full of something that is intended to kill them for. Don't you dare tell them about the side effects. Don't you dare tell them about the election rig that we use to make all this possible. Senator Rand Paul called it the most consequential free speech case in U.S. history. And the oral arguments included one of the most blithering morons in the swamp, not just ever to put on a black robe, but this woman, right, she doesn't even know what a woman is. I don't even know if she looks in the mirror in the nude if she knows what a woman is. Anyway, she says to the attorney representing the plaintiffs, your view has the First Amendment hamstringing the government. Every time I read that, I marvel at the stupidity of some people. You don't understand what the point of the Bill of Rights is? The point of the Bill of Rights is to hamstring the government, to say Congress shall make no law. You can't restrict freedom of speech, assembly, worship. You can't do all the things you've been doing. You can't use somebody else. You can't coerce an intermediary, a public-private partner, to do your dirty work for you. What do you not understand about no? Oh, yeah, and by the way, if you don't get it, that's what the Second Amendment is for, so that eventually people will say, I've had enough of this insanity, and they stop it. Well, that doesn't stand either, does it? So I've got another piece here about the amica briefs. This is the Friends of the Court brief. And essentially, what the author here, and this is from the Brownstone Institute and others point out, is that everybody that was lobbying the Supreme Court to say, screw free speech, put an end to it, put a wooden stake in it, the level of evil here cannot be overstated. One side, and you know which side it is, carries the combined power of the intelligence community, you know, the one that told you the laptop was a lie, take your Zyklon B and die, and the Big Brother's federal government, colluding with the largest information centers in the history of the world on behalf of the world's and country's largest lobbying forces. On the other side, independent doctors, news outlets, and state attorneys general. Four federal judges have found that the Biden-Fuhrer, the FBI, the Surgeon General, the CDC, the Department of Homeland Security, all of them, violated the First Amendment in an ongoing collaboration with big tech to censor any disapproved narratives, including but not limited to those related to COVID, crime, and mail-in voting, and the election theft, and you name it. And Brownstone has reviewed all the amici curiae briefs in Murphy v. Missouri and found that it's a huge coalition, including Stanford University and the other elements of just, you know, just plain evil. You read through this stuff and you go, how can this be? Are people really this stupid? Judge Alito blasted to Facebook and the partnership between them and Big Brother. So we got at least one or two. But as Matt Taibbi pointed out, when this blithering idiot Brown Jackson talks about hamstringing the federal government, not one justice, and that includes the decent ones, Alito and Clarence Thomas, not one of them said, "Are you stupid? Don't you recognize that's the point of the Bill of Rights?" So even the silence speaks volumes. I have to admit, folks, I see the clergy response team, I see all of this stuff, and I can't help but think, watch this case extremely carefully. They're not going to say anything about it. They're going to wait till it gets off the front pages. It'll come back. But they're talking about maybe by June they'll let people know, do you still even pretend to have free speech or not? And I'll suggest that what they'll do is they'll come up with a convoluted, narrowly focused ruling, which will be spun exactly the way that the whores want it to be spun, and people will go back to sleep.
And they'll say, well, we don't really have free speech anymore, but I guess we can't talk about it anyway, so what difference does it make? But this is arguably going to be the beginning of the end. Are we going to see what should happen is it should be tomorrow. There's no reason to wait. 9-0, the justices say, are you kidding me? Free speech is free speech. And to have the government coercing anybody, press or socialist media platforms or whatever, to say you can't speak and we're going to censor third parties? Wrong. If they don't say that, it's just like what we saw with the clergy response team. The silence speaks volumes. It's like what my subtitle was for today's presentation. It's not what you say, it's what you don't say. Unintentional sin. See, they're sending it intentionally, and they're telling you, you're supposed to believe we're so stupid, we don't know what shall not be infringed means. We don't know what Congress shall make no law means, and that what free speech means, and that we can put people in the gulags for pretending that they have a right to protest or petition the government for a redress of grievances. How much will the American people put up with? How much of this clergy response team stuff are they going to allow to be crammed down their throats? Now, I'm going to tie all of this together in a second. I want to read one more quick piece, just an intro. This is from Victor David Hansen. It's a great summary. It's called From Russia to Russia, Russia Collusion to the most recent one, right, the bloodbath. Remember Trump saying that there would be a bloodbath if they stole the next election? And people are saying, did he really come out and say that? Maybe he was talking about cars. And you know what? I think it was a double entendre, that it's time to admit that if they steal another election and say you don't have any free speech, there is going to be a bloodbath. And the truth is, it's probably coming about 4 years too late. Because by now, the foreign invading terrorists and soldiers and MS-13 and gang members, they've already not only come into the country, they've been distributed to their cells, and they've been armed by the same people that armed the traitors and terrorists and Taliban in Afghanistan. All right, back to Victor Davis Hanson. He says, since Trump went down the escalator, we've been seeing controversial agendas, tariffs, China, illegal immigration, foreign policy, NATO. There has become a level of left-wing toxic hysteria. I like that term, toxic hysteria, which has become the norm. In the last 10 years, we've witnessed, now there's a list here, it runs about 20 sentences, it's a big run-on sentence. We've witnessed the following. Russia, 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 the collusion hoax. Calls from military officers and analysts for extra legal interventions, coups, torture. The Alpha Ping hoax, the drinking bleach hoax, the sucker D-Day hoax, the celebrity contest about the best way to decapitate, stab, blow up, or incinerate Trump. The 2016 left-wing post-election efforts to turn state electors into faithless apostates to elect Hitlery. Remember? When they tried to overturn that election, that was not a crime. Nobody went to the federal gulags. The nutty Mark Milley call to his Chinese counterparts. Remember, he told them that if Trump tried to do anything, he would rat out to his generals in communist China, his buddies. What a... The Antifa BLM riots of 2020. The effort to storm the White House grounds. The first two impeachments of a sitting president in the same first term. The laptop Russia, Russia, Russia disinfo hoax. The P accusation. Remember P in Moscow? The 51 intelligence authorities. The Twitter censors. The Senate trial of a private citizen. The January 6th Fed surrection, where five police officers were killed, which was all the time a lie. Letitia James, find me the man, I'll find you the crime. And that's a quote. The monstrous $350 million fine growing daily to well over $500 million now. Alvin Bragg, Fannie Willis, Nathan Wade, Jack Smith, Robert Herr, the effort to bankrupt the Republican nominee, steal his stuff, calls to pack the court in the Senate filibuster, and so forth and so on. I mean, all of this is just downright amazing. And finally, he says, we know the more they tried to destroy Trump through media lies and distortions, the greater his resiliency and popularity. Two, the greater the left-wing media hysteria, the venom and the furor, the more leftists melt down and project their own paranoia onto Trump. Now, this is a funny argument, and I've heard it before and thought about it myself, because basically what they're saying is, hey, if he gets elected and he realizes what we are doing to him, why, damn it, he'll do the same thing to us. He'll treat us the way we're treating him, and we're not about to put up with that. He'll take away our stuff. He may even try to execute us for treason, because that's what we're guilty of, and we all know it. So, naturally, he says, they know that Trump will do to us what we would do to us if we were in his place. Well, whether he does or not,
At least you could have to admit there would be justification for it. Back to the issue today. This is where I really want to try to encourage people to think about this, pray about this, and be aware of what's coming. And yeah, I'm going to suggest maybe this is where we need to exercise some patience too. Now, we're not to keep silent, and you'll notice I will not keep silent. So when it comes to the whores, when it comes to the clergy response team, to those minions of Satan who walk in men's souls and literally sell people for filthy lucre, they make Judas look almost like a saint. Okay? No, I don't mean it that way. They did exactly, if you think about it, they did exactly what Judas did. They sold him, the Mashiach, out for a little bit more than 30 pieces of silver, though. Maybe for a G4 and a taxpayer-paid manse. But they did it just as sure as hell as Judas ever did. And not only that, they lie about it to this day. Judas at least had the courtesy to go and commit suicide. All right, if we sin willfully after having received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, because there is no such thing as unintentional sin when we think we've been washed clean. He don't put him to death on the cross again, right? Just what remains? A certain fearful expectation of judgment and fiery indignation, which will devour the adversaries. Anyone who's rejected the Torah of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. So, how much worse do you think the punishment will be to those who were thought worthy but trampled the Son of Elohim underfoot and counted the blood of the covenant by which that person was sanctified a base, a common, a trivial thing? And they insulted the Ruach Elohim. Because we know the one who said, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay," says Yahuwah, and Yahuwah will judge his people. It is, in fact, a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living Elohim. So let me wrap it up with that. I'm gonna suggest today that it has never been more important that we recognize just how close we are on so many fronts. The law front, where the court has become not even a parody of a joke or a circus. We got a court that says, we can't have the rule of law. Hell, the rule of law might hamstring Big Brother from doing what we need to do to you peons. And all I did was just basically tell you what she's thinking. And you know what? Again, not one of the eight other justices even stood up and said, for crying out loud, are you that stupid? They stood there. They let it go. They kept silent. Well, we're not supposed to keep silent, folks. We're supposed to recognize the difference. And this is about as vital as it gets. Yes, I think a lot of us have known about the clergy response team for decades, but we're seeing it. And I'll say it again, you know, if this message gets out and it falls on non-deaf ears and people who recognize, damn, that's what my whore preacher, that's what he's been doing. He's been prepping us. He's been selling us the LGBTQ agenda. The carbon dioxide will kill you. So don't breathe out again, you stupid peons. He's been selling us all that crap. He's been telling us to be afraid, be very afraid, not of the living God, but of what the prince of this world can do to you if you don't have your mark of the beast. By the way, God won't send you to hell for that. How much crap like this are people going to put up with? How long is it going to be till they recognize that even the Supreme Court isn't going to save you? Because they do what? They wear the nine black robes of a different God. They're not talking about the one that they put their hand on a Bible and swore to preserve, protect, and defend. Otherwise, they wouldn't have sat still through that so-called oral argument session the other day. Part one, I guess, is to wake up and recognize it. And then I encourage folks to study some of this. There are so many things here in Vayikra. We're going to talk about a number of them over the next few weeks as we look at this book. Things that we've been told aren't important, things that are done away with. And guess what? What's been done away with is the vital distinction between unintentional sin and deliberate rebellion, to the point where what we have are a whole bunch of fake priests, fake fathers, fake preachers, clergy response team, and other whores on behalf of the prince of this world lying to people. And it's true. It's not what you say that matters most. Sometimes when it comes to things that are left out, it's what you don't say. And what they don't say is they're walking in deliberate rebellion. Are they really that stupid, or do they know it?
I'll say it again. Okay, I could believe people might be, and Torah obviously says that there might even be an anointed Kohen who's a bit ignorant, has a blind spot, does something which Yahuwah says not to do. Do I believe that a clergy response team member who's drinking the Romans 13 Kool-Aid and basically convincing his flock, go out and go into the chambers? Oh yeah, I know that the Lutheran priest did it for Hitler. That was okay. You've heard the old saying, it's true saying, that you know, when the trains would go by en route to Auschwitz and they would hear the screams, the dying cries of people on the train saying, let us out, let us out, pastor would turn to the congregation and then he'd turn to the choir and say, sing louder, sing louder. Can't be hearing that stuff. Folks, we are at a time where we got all kinds of whores telling people to sing louder and ignore the obvious truth. Question? Are they really that ignorant, or are they in deliberate rebellion to the creator of the universe? How much worse punishment do you suppose will be thought worthy of him who has trampled the Son of Elohim underfoot, preaching another Jesus in his stead that we've not preached, counted the blood of his covenant by which that person was supposedly sanctified, a common, a base, a trivial thing, hey, nailed to the cross, done away with, forget about it, and insulted the Ruach Elohim in the process? Little blasphemy, why not? Right? They're doing everything else. Do I excuse them? Hell no. Am I suggesting that we go out and... Well, no, I'm not going to even go finish that sentence. I will say the following. We are told, A, do not keep silent. Study to show yourself approved. Be able to discern, and I'll say it again, that vital distinction between unintentional sin and outright in-your-face rebellion. And B, what do we do about it? Come out of her, my people. Do not touch the unclean thing. Do not participate in the whore church. Don't go to Sun God Day school and sit there and be fed crap about how LGBTQ, we love God just as much as those who honor his word and really think he meant what he said. Because they don't. And who are we kidding? You don't believe that they're that stupid, do you really? Once you wake up, once you've seen it, right? For if we sin willfully after having received the knowledge of the truth, it's kind of hard to pretend we just can't see it anymore. Now, I recognize, and this is important, and I quote it frequently, Isaiah 66. And I guess what I should do is just read it today, because it's important. He says, Isaiah 66, verses 3 and 4, just as they've chosen their own ways, and their soul delights in their abominations, so will I choose their delusions. James Howard Kunstler wrote about the sane versus the insane. The insane folks, they are victims of their own evil. Because you have rejected knowledge, I'll reject you for being priests for me, said Hosea. Now he has chosen their delusions. What does he tell them? I will bring your fears upon you, because when I called, they didn't answer. When I spoke, they did not hear. But they did evil before my eyes, and chose that in which I do not delight. Could it be any more clear? Hear the word of Yahuwah. This is to the rest of us. You who tremble at his word, your brethren who hated you, who cast you out for my name's sake. Guess what? I've been kicked out all kinds of churches. And looking back, I'm not sad about any of it. Who cast you out for my name's sake, he said. Let Yahuwah be glorified that we may see your joy. They, on the other hand, they shall be ashamed. Well, you know, I guess that's good. I hope that they will be ashamed. I wish, I pray, shame, masses of shame upon them. Maybe in time to save them from what Paul, or whoever the author of Hebrews here, says is, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living Elohim. How much worse punishment if you don't? So bear all of that in mind. Again, we are at a time that I think is just plain unbelievable in terms of history. So many things coming to a crux. And I'll admit this, the things that I've seen out of the so-called legal community and the courts, Letitia James, Fannie Willis, okay, conflict of interest. Used to be that was disqualifying. And even a crooked attorney would disqualify themselves from a case when their clear conflict of interest was revealed. Or even an appearance of a conflict of interest. Fannie Willis has been caught lying to the court. And the judge doesn't even have the chutzpah to throw her sick ass out of there and say, you need to be disbarred and sent to prison too, for perjury. The fact that this continues tells you everything you need to know about a court system, folks, that has nothing to do with the rule of law. So what does that tell us again? Come out of her, my people.
I guess when it's all said and done, I have to add one more thing. Not only do we come out, we have to recognize, fear not him who can kill the body, because they intend to do a lot of that. And I didn't even talk about it, probably 100 other stories today that all basically point in that same direction. They're importing terrorists. They're importing foreign military. They are destroying the economy. They are trying to provoke World War III. They are doing everything they can to destroy the food system, the supply chains, the economic system, the power grid. You name it, folks. The regime has either already destroyed it, or they have weakened it to the point where it'll teeter and then topple at the first open sign that the jig is up. So here we are. Come out. Be separate. And do not be fooled. And try to study. Go back and look at some of these things that the whore church has lied to us about and said don't matter anymore. Because the distinctions that are ignored, that are omitted, are really vital. And they begin to tell us things that, just like what we will see with the Supreme Court, it's what we won't hear there. In that case, I guarantee you there'll be certain words. We could probably drop a list of them that will not show up in that final brief decision from the Almighty Supreme Court when and if it comes down. So be paying attention to all of these things. All right, I didn't see any questions. So let's close in prayer. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba, we come before you. We thank you, Father, for your word. We thank you for the fact that your word has been preserved. And that we can study to show ourselves approved, that we have some tools, we have the ability to look at and see things that our fathers' fathers couldn't have seen simply because they didn't have the level of technology to look at the meaning of words and to see things that you've preserved for us that we do now. I know that many of them did, in fact, see the truth, and we're thankful for that. But we pray that you would give us today eyes to see and ears to hear, because we know that the level of deception is greater, just as is the level of technology, and they, sadly, so often go together. So we pray, Father, that you'd give us your guidance, that you would fill us with your Ruach, that you would show us the things that we would rightly divide your word of truth, be able to use it as a sharp double-edged sword that it is, to separate bone from marrow and soul from spirit, and walk in the power and authority that you have given us. Help us to be ready to escape, to do the things, even greater things that you have said than we've seen before, that we'll need to do in these times ahead. Help us to come out, to be separate. Help us to walk the narrow path and to veer neither to the right nor to the left. Let your Torah be a lamp to our feet, we pray. But we pray, too, that you would help us to be bold, to speak your truth boldly, to not keep silent when the time comes. Fill us with your Ruach. Guide us in the things you would have us say as we stand for you and for your word. Help us to witness to friends, to neighbors, to loved ones, to adversaries when the time comes. Above all, we pray that we would be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming, that we'd be found doing your work, and that we would be good and faithful servants unto you. And all this we ask in your set-apart name, for you are our King, our Savior, our Redeemer, our help in times of trouble. Yahuwah Zadiknu, Yahuwah Vitzivenu, Yahuwah Zevuot. Our banner, Yahuwah Nisi. Our healer, Yahuwah Rapha. Hallelujah. Amen. Okay, I see the comment. I can't argue with that from Heinrich that we need to probably start fasting from here through April the 8th. And yeah, if you don't know what's happening on April the 8th, that's the final part of the X, or whatever it may be, that crosses the United States from the Mexican border in southwest Texas up through New York, and certainly will be interesting. But I think there'll be a lot of other interesting things that are happening either before or up to and even beyond as well. So it's definitely a time to be paying attention. All right, well then, let's begin to wrap up the live part today with the Aharonic blessing. We remember that Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, "Speak and turn to Aharon and his sons, and say to them, this is how you bless the B'nai Yisrael. Say to them, Yivarecha ka Yahuwah v'adishmarecha, Ya'er Yahuwah panavaleka v'ichunecha, Isayahu hu 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 V'asim lecha shalom. May Yahuwah bless you and keep you. May Yahuwah make his face to shine upon you. May Yahuwah lift his countenance upon you and give you his shalom, omen. And thus he said, they shall put Shemi, my name, on the B'nai Yisrael, and I myself shall bless them. And may it be so.